Hi, Kirby.
Hi, Sarah.
Welcome to Los Angeles.
Welcome, Glamgelinos.
We hope you stay a while.
Cute. That's cute.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Press and go. Just press and go.
That's our motto.
Life's a show when you just press and go.
No, literally, that's our 2024 motto.
Just press and go.
We don't have time for glue. We need to just press and go.
Stop with the glue. Glue is so 2002.
Wow.
We're talking about impress, press on falsies, and press on manicure. The impress press on falsies are these lashes that require zero glue. They have a variety of different styles. I personally am a fan of the natural and also the wispies. I like applying a few just to the corner of my eyes. And honestly, this is faster for me than applying mascara. It is so quick. I gotta also tell you the falsies, one thing I forgot to mention, they're the underlash. It's underneath the lash. So they look super, super realistic. No glue, just press and go.
Speaking of press and go, let's talk about the Impress No Glue Manis that I am obsessed with. If you follow me, you know that I am in my press-on era right now because I do not have time to sit in the chair at the salon like many of you for like 2 hours. And that's fine because thanks to Impress, you can have a super fabulous mani in seconds. You don't have to apply any glue. They come in all different styles, and the Impress manicure has a patented super hold adhesive for up to 7 days.
If you want to try the no glue mani or press on falsies from Impress that won't damage your nails or lashes, just go to Impress, that's impressbeauty.com/Los Angeles, and then use our code Los Angeles to check out for 25% off Impress manicure and press on falsies. We are getting into spring. By the time this goes live, maybe it will be spring. I don't know yet. Spring is such a weird season, in my opinion, because it feels like it should be in March, but it's later in March, I guess, and it's still cold.
Are there even seasons anymore?
That's true. Spring is always cold to me. Like, unless you get into May and then you're like, all right. But spring, for the most part, stays cold, so whatever. But the point is you should be wearing sunscreen no matter what anyways. So this topic is always relevant. And we know that our community is obsessed with sunscreen and wearing SPF, but there's also a lot of questions around it. How much should you really be wearing? Is it bad if you don't wear as much as these people on the internet say that you need to be wearing? Like, are there good and bad sunscreens? All of these things. I had the privilege of visiting this founder, Sophie Bai, at her lab in Boston at MIT, which was incredible last year. And she was such a wealth of knowledge, specifically when it comes to mineral sunscreens, which I know a lot of people gravitate towards because it's non-irritating. However, it's not usually the most inclusive. And so we wanted to have Sophie on to pick her brain about all things SPF, sunscreen, testing. She knows so much. And I know I'm continuing to talk, but I want to give her a little intro here because this woman is an actual genius. Sophie was recognized by NASA at the age of 16 for discovering an anti-aging compound, which is, Sarah, what were you doing at 16? We were both fangirling over JC Chazet. That's what we were doing.
Recording NSYNC performances on a VHS tape.
Right.
So I could watch
trying to learn Darren's dance groups. Meanwhile, Sophie is discovering an anti-aging compound. She goes on to earn a Bachelor in Science in Chemical Engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. There, she learned how to create vehicles for targeted delivery of cancer drugs technology that would later inform her innovative approach to skincare, which leverages a transdermal delivery system. Then, we're not done. She earned her master's of business administration from Harvard Business School. And before starting Pavish, she founded PPeople, which is, or PPEople, rather. It's an accelerated venture philanthropy vehicle that imported and distributed 2 million pieces of PPE to 27 hospitals and senior care facilities in Massachusetts during the COVID-19 pandemic in the spring of 2020. Wow. Okay. So literally, that's not even all of it. There's so much more to Sophie, but needless to say, she is extremely qualified to speak on this topic. Being a brand founder that creates an SPF, she knows the ins and outs of testing and all of those things, and we're going to get into it.
Sophie, I'm sure that you've been asked this many times because from here, your face is glowing and gorgeous, but we need to know, what is on your face?
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I adore you too so much and love this podcast. What's on my face? So I'm very lazy. I don't have a very extensive skincare routine. So I wake up, I have, you know, clearly the Pavish Dynamic Age Defense, that. But today I actually have Akzone. So it's a prescription topical for acne. I have very bad acne and eczema. So it's by Allergan. It's called Akzone. It works really well for me, for my acne. So I have that. And I have Latisse. So it's the, you know, lash growth serum, also by Allergan. I love Latisse because it's an accidental discovery. It was not created for, you know, growing lashes. It was for glaucoma, was for eye condition. And those patients, you know, using this topical a couple weeks later, being like, oh my gosh, my lashes are growing crazy. So that's how it pivoted into, you know, Latisse today. So I love that because that's how true science is. It's never intended. If we just wanted to say, okay, we scientists want to cure cancer, we would have cured cancer by now. Most of the scientific discoveries are accidental. And of course, lip is the tinted lip oil, the Pavish lip defense. And I use that as my blush as well. So that's pretty much what's on my face.
Sophie, I have to say, I just tried the lip defense and I think it's going to be a new fave.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear. What color are you using?
What pot color is this one? This is, what is this one? It's like the red one.
Oh, 774.
774.
Yeah. The naming actually is the wavelength of the light. So it's 774 nanometer of the light that is this color. So we're very nerdy about how we name.
The number is here and I was like, I don't know what the name is.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
a number.
We're very nerdy about how we name our products. So yeah, I'm wearing 604 nanometer of the light that is this color. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I'm love obsessed. That. I love that. Now, Glamgelinos, you've heard me talk about Pavish on this podcast. If you have my newsletter, you've seen me write about it. I really, really do love this sunscreen. And the name of it is Dynamic Age Defense.
Yes.
Is that right?
We call it, yeah, we call it DAD, D-A-D. It's easier.
Daddy. So I truly do love this product. It is a, in my opinion, well, price-wise, prestige product. But as I've talked on previous episodes, it's kind of like the 3-in-1. So you're getting your sunscreen, you're getting your moisture, and then you're getting like an actual treatment. A lot of people that I've turned this on to are saying that they have noticed significant changes with their skin, which makes me happy as someone who also loves it. But Sophie, okay, I'm going to go back to the anti-aging compound.
Yeah.
How do you discover something like that? Like, where were you? Clearly you must, I mean, I don't know. Did you have a lab in your house? Like, what was going on that like gave you the ability to discover this? This is crazy.
Yeah, I certainly peaked when I was 16 and everything was downhill afterwards. But jokes aside, So my parents both are engineers. My mom is a mechanical engineer. She designs engines for motorcycles. And my dad is an electrical engineer. So I grew up in an engineer family. And I was so obsessed with pills. I remember probably 3, 4, 5 years old because I see, you know, my grandparents or my mom takes them. And then all of a sudden, they're not sick anymore. I was like, wow, what's more powerful than this tiny little pill that can make people feel so much better immediately or can save people's lives? So that's when I was so obsessed with medicine. But I was actually born in a small town in China. You know, we in our province, we have 200 million people, but not a tier one good school, not good healthcare systems. The only way for me to get better education, to get out of my province, was to try to be recruited nationally in the national science team. So I started my 7-year long journey to compete in math and science starting at the age of 7. So I competed, I became number one in my province of 200 million people, and I made it to the national science team. And since then, you know, because on that team, you do have a lot more resources because you do compete on behalf of China. And that's when I started, you know, we have the resources, you know, we are taught college materials of STEM at the age of 14. And we have to do lab work. And if you, you know, decide to pursue physics, chemistry, and biology. So that's how I had the privilege to be able to work in the lab in such a young age. But even with that, you know, I was knocking doors for different universities in Shanghai, and they just thought I was a joke. They're like, what are you doing? This is not an amusement park. Don't even, you know, try to waste my time. And, you know, luckily I have a thick skin and I don't take no for an answer. And, you know, yeah, like probably 20 professors have said no. And eventually it took me 4.5 months to convince one professor that I'm capable of working like just like your PhD postdoc student. So that's when I started working in his lab and eventually discovered the anti-aging compound.
Wow.
Take that, other professors.
Yeah. I mean, I just am truly in awe because, I mean, clearly you wanted to have better education for yourself, like to be number one out of all of those people. And then also to have like the actual wherewithal and the desire to do that is awesome. I feel like I was a motivated kid, but definitely not as motivated as Sophie.
Same.
So truly incredible stuff there. So what can you tell us about this compound? Was it a happy accident? And then what does it do specifically?
Yeah, it was definitely an accident. I wasn't set out to, you know, do aging research, right? As a 16-year-old, what did I know about aging, you know? So it was in the beginning, I was looking at, you know, like a cancer research, right? So it was overgrowth of cells. And we were trying to find different ways to stimulate cancer growth. And out of which I actually found a class of compound doesn't stimulate cancer cells, but does stimulate normal cells. That's when I had this aha moment. Wait, so it doesn't make cancer cells grow. Does it make normal, healthy cells grow? What does that mean? So that's when I went down this path. And, you know, to look into potentially this could extend lifespan, right? It wasn't about face. It was more about, can people live longer and healthier? Can people live past 100, 120, 150 years? So we started with a very classic model, which is fruit flies. Fruit flies is a very typical aging research material because they typically live around 40 to 60 days. So it's easier to see, you know, like, are we able to induce aging or induce longevity to fruit flies? And we saw that compound or that class of compound at that time was able to double the lifespan of fruit flies. And that was very significant. So then we started working on other, you know, model materials because studying aging is very difficult. You can't, you know, okay, eat this, take this, or inject this, and let us watch when you die, right? It's impossible. So that's why, you know, we also did a lot of human cell in vitro studies and did a lot of gene studies like genetic modulation. So we found out that class of compound does regulate aging associated genes. So gene P16 and P53 and P27. So we did study the mechanisms of action of how those compounds were able to regulate the aging process to basically extend healthy lifespan, because nobody wants to live longer but not have the vitality or energy to do anything, right? So it's always about age well and how can we add a number to our life but not losing the vitality that we have in our 20s and 30s.
Wow. Okay, so then,
yeah,
I mean,
Cool.
So cool. Pretty cool, Sophie. But like, what happened after you discovered the compound? Like, where did you go from there?
Yeah, so that was 16, 17, and I got full ride at MIT. And, you know, not because of that, NASA named a minor planet after me for my scientific discovery. So, you know, I also got full ride to Caltech, but I chose MIT because they allowed me to work as a freshman in a PhD and postdoc lab. So that's how I immediately joined Langer Lab. So Bob Langer, he is the co-founder of Moderna and 40 other public biotech companies. And he is the Edison in medicine. So I was very privileged to work as the youngest researcher ever in his lab. And that's when, you know, there were moments of, you know, like me as a girl growing up in a small town and all of a sudden being into this wonderland. Because, you know, at that time, Moderna was already born. It was 15 years ago. And people were already working on Moderna and, you know, gene therapies, but people just don't know, right? So I felt like, wow, I'm in this magic world. I see things that's going to happen 10, 20, 30 years later. So that's, you know, like, I think there were a lot of debate or, I guess, scientific controversies around aging, where most of the focus is really around cancer oncology. So that's why I started immediately working on cancer drugs. So I worked on prostate cancer, lung cancer. I also worked on type 1 diabetes.
Do you think that, okay, so this anti-aging compound, this reminds me of, you know, you're talking about like the longevity of life and seeing if we can like extend people's lifespan. I don't even want that for humans. I want that for dogs. And apparently like there's something like that on the market right now that it's not, you know, FDA approved yet. And they like want to get it there, but they wanted to like get it out on the market. Do you see a future for dog longevity? I would do anything to make sure Quinn could live like 40 years or something.
No, literally. I like looked up if like I could submit Ollie as like a test subject, like a volunteer.
So I actually have friends working on that, and there are very initial early results to show there are molecules, compound out there could extend lifespan of animals, including dogs. So that is a possibility.
But I listened to a story on NPR about it, and they were talking about like you were saying with like the vitality, where they weren't sure like they were extending the lifespan, but the quality of life, like, was it actually good or not? Which, you know, that's obviously important. But that is so cool, Sophie, that you know friends who are working on that. Well, if they need any.
I mean, I think the coolest thing in recent years I have seen my friend is he created this technology. It's a virus. So it's actually a viral factor or vector in a way. You shoot that viral factor into your ear, and all of a sudden you cure hearing loss.
Is that meant for like elderly people who have hearing loss, or like people who are born with like
people who are born? So mainly children. So people who are born with genetic hearing loss, and that's how basically they were able to modify gene. So it's kind of like a gene therapy in a way. So to correct that gene so you can hear again. So like my friend, Manny Simmons, he's a founder and scientist of this technology. They sold it to Eli Lilly 2 years ago. Yeah.
That is incredible. I will tell you, after having two small children, when you have your baby, they do like the hearing test at the hospital before they let you go. And it is like the most stressful test because you don't know what's going. You're like, I don't know, can they hear? And it's like sometimes you're like just like looking at them, look at like the results, and you're like, is it working? Like, does this work? And so like I can only imagine like this would change obviously people's lives. And I'm sure it's like when you find it initially, it's probably easier to like to mutate their genes or whatever. Yeah. Wow, that's incredible. Okay, let's talk about what you also, the many other things you did at MIT. You invented, co-invented, and patented multiple proprietary molecules to provide cures and treatment for eczema, atopic dermatitis, skin cancer, and skin aging.
Yes.
What did you learn about each of these individual skin issues in your journey of finding cures for this. What did you find most interesting about them?
Yeah, so I think it's related to your early question, right? Like, you know, from aging researcher then to oncology and now to dermatology. I didn't really have a choice when I was in college, right? So it really is where the funding is. So what are the research teams? What can I do? And, you know, like as aging is a hot debate because people, there's a school of thought, think aging is a disease, but there's a school of thought it isn't. Right. So it really hinders its ability to get government grant. Right. So a lot of the scientific research happening in academia are funded by NIH, but mainly funding, you know, like all of the funds are going towards oncology, immunology, gene therapy. Right. Because they are deemed to be more life threatening. Right. So like they think those are more serious diseases and they don't think aging is. And they also don't think dermatology is. So that's where. You know, I remember in the early days, fun fact, so Living Proof is actually also born from the lab I was at. But at that time, I remember like a lot of people were like, oh, Sophie, you know, like you should work on Living Proof. And by that time, you know, like a young and naive me, I was like, I want to cure cancer and save people's lives. So I think it's still much of that kind of sentiment among scientists, especially in academia. And also that, you know, like really hinders the ability of if you're saying, oh, I want to create, you know, like not even a skincare, but let's say I want to create an acne drug, it might not get funding as easily if you were to say, I want to create a drug for prostate cancer, right? So I think because of the lack of funding that, you know, didn't really allow me to pursue dermatology in the earlier days. But the reason I eventually did that was my first task was drug delivery. So drug delivery, you know, I remember when I tell people, they're like FedEx, like UPS. I'm like, no, like drug delivery, similar concept, but it really is to move molecule from A to B. But this A to B is not from Boston to Los Angeles. It is within your body. How do we, let's say, move it from where it is into, let's say, prostate without being detected by your own immune system, right? Think about cancer drugs. Cancer drugs, how it works, because it's highly toxic. It kills cancer cells. But because it's highly toxic, it typically will kill normal cells too. That's why chemotherapy is so bad, right? Like, that's why, you know, like, cancer treatment can be very invasive. So at that time, my task was, Sophie, you need to create a delivery mechanism that can find prostate cancer cells and attach to them so that the drug can be released, right? But also to escape the detection of your immune system, because once it's detected, your white blood cells will eat those drugs up and it will never reach the prostate. So that was what I was trying to solve at that time. And that is drug delivery, basically moving this molecule from A to B, but have to overcome so many obstacles within your own body. And, you know, probably how many, so like this is also the principle for Moderna as well. How do you deliver mRNA to the right place, right? Because mRNAs are super fragile. And all like within the drug delivery realm, there's one subset that is transdermal drug delivery. So how do you get molecules into the skin without needles? So that's also a field that is actually pioneered by my boss, Bob Langer. So I was really working on that. And that's when I was like, a lot of skincare products don't work because, you know, like they have a hard time getting it. And, I myself is very obsessed with skin because I have terrible skin growing up. Like you see the glow flawless, but you know, I wasn't looking like this when I was younger. And as a professional mathlete, so I call myself a mathlete. Like I compete here, you know, like I exercise here, but I'm terrible at any sports. So don't ever try to put me on any sports team. I will lose. I guarantee you that. And I was participating in this public speaking contest. The topic was how youth can contribute to the society. And you know, in my whole life, I never thought I was smart or the smartest. I always think I work harder. I work harder than my peers so that I may have a leg up because I overprepare. So with this, I was like, okay, I did do a lot of work for this, but when I went to the competition, I had acne and eczema flare up. The judges who were teachers in front of audience of 1,000 people said that I looked ugly. They didn't want to listen to what I had to say. And I was kicked out of the competition. It was the first time, you know, in my life, I felt like maybe it's not about working hard. Like maybe it's sometimes something wrong with me that I'm not good enough. Doesn't matter what I do to deserve some opportunities. So that was part of, I guess, you know, looking back, why I was always so obsessed with skin. It was from that, because I couldn't solve that problem. And I didn't eat lunch for a week after that, because I actually saved that money to buy my very first Maybelline foundation to cover myself up. You know, like as a beauty user, I have like, what, 25 years experience. That's, you know, like when I was like, a lot of people, especially in academia, or even in serious drug development, scientists, right? They don't understand the impact of what your skin can have on you. They don't think that's life-threatening compared to, yeah, prostate cancer. But it certainly can feel as awful, as painful for a lot of people. And especially, I think, for girls, I think that the society hasn't been very kind to women in terms of we need to be perfect. And that's when I just had this idea. Why don't I bring everything I learned from oncology, from immunology, from gene editing, all of those exciting research going on, to dermatology, right? So that's when I started this. And, you know, I think that's where a lot of the professors at MIT, Harvard, and Yale, they all agree that they think, you know, skincare can be healthcare and should be treated like healthcare. But yeah, like through all those years working on the different, you know, indications on dermatology, truly is, I think the biggest barrier really is transdermal delivery. How, you know, we have seen a lot of ingredients hold a lot of promises that it works in vitro, it works in the cell dish that doesn't have this very complex skin barrier or stratum corneum and other stuff underneath it. So, That is the biggest learning, and that is what our company is very good at, is actually to create different transdermal drug delivery technologies to target different layers or different disease per se, right? Because what's the root cause for atopic dermatitis, certainly very different. For skin aging, certainly very different than rosacea, certainly very different than skin cancer. But again, how do you get the molecule into the right spot? That is the most tricky part.
Yeah, and I guarantee you a lot of people listening to this are kind of mind blown, because they've probably never thought about that. They've never thought about the delivery system outside of, like you said, FedEx or UPS. Since you mentioned, you know, talking about like skincare being healthcare, we know that sun care is healthcare. When it comes to sunscreen as a sunscreen developer, I want to know what your point of view is on the current regulation of sunscreen in the U.S. I keep thinking about what sunscreen developers are up against in this country. There's so many other more sophisticated ingredients out there. Anytime Sarah and I travel abroad, we're bringing home loads of sunscreen. In your opinion, like what are you up against, and like why are we often seeing a lot of the same types of sunscreens be produced here in the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think there are different challenges for different groups, right? So for formulators, right, for cosmetic chemists or product developers, they have a really tough job, because number one, sunscreen is already very difficult to formulate, especially mineral sunscreen, because they are not soluble, right? So they're not dissolved in oil or water. So it's very difficult to formulate and to make it stable. And the choices are very limited, right? Because as a cosmetic formulator or cosmetic chemist, you choose from what's available in front of you. And the choices we have are limited. So they have a very tough job, right? Because consumers, everybody wants the best of both worlds, right? They want non-greasy, they want no irritation, they want transparent, they want cosmetic elegance, like they want everything. But unfortunately, not a lot can deliver everything. So I think that's what they're up against, that they don't have more options to create products that people want. And I, as a drug developer, so my challenge is that I create new molecules, right? So I don't do the formulation part, but I create new molecules. My challenge is around how do I get FDA approval? Because it is regulated as a drug in this country. And that is why we have fewer options compared to the rest of the world, because most countries regulate like a cosmetic or a pseudo drug, quasi drug in Japan. That, you know, it's faster to get to market. However, I do want to give FDA the credit for issuing their new proposed rule on sunscreens. Why do I say that? So facts. When is the last time there's a new filter was approved in this country?
Wasn't it like 1999?
Yeah, 1999. Okay. So 25 years ago. And that was Nick. So we haven't had anything new. But to our surprise, FDA actually did a human trial on skin absorption, right, permeation of all UV filters, that they did a very comprehensive human study to detect if there are alarming amount for sunscreen filters, right, that includes mineral filters. And what they found is that, you know, they found out after one application of a chemical sunscreen, all of the filters, chemical filters are detected in your blood, urine, and breast milk to the amount that for FDA's sake is that this is a threshold they are regulating for every single drug in this country. If you do pass the threshold in your blood, we do require more safety data because we don't know the long-term effect. So it's not just, okay, we hate sunscreens, we need to make it even more difficult. It is the fact that the results came back in human studies that is way above the FDA allowed threshold that will trigger additional safety data, just given, you know, sunscreen has been moving from occasional vacational summer use to a daily product. They don't know the long-term effects. Nobody knows, right? Think about FDA. Their role is to make sure their product, number one, works. Number two, do no harm. That's their job, right? So how they're asking to provide more of the do no harm side of the things. So I do give them credit to conduct that study to show some of the early data. But does chemical sunscreens do harm to humans? We do not know. Because it is unethical, let's say, because people are saying, oh, like, you know, birth defects in zebrafish. Okay, who is willing to, as a pregnant person, say, enroll me in this trial, see if chemical food are going to kill my baby? Nobody's going to do that. So because of all of ethical issues, the effect of chemical UV filters in our body's impact long-term will still remain unknown. But what is known is skin cancer is real. Sunscreen do prevent against skin cancer. So that is a known risk, right? And then you're weighing against something unknown. So, you know, that is this whole saga, I would say, around chemical UV filters. And, you know, on the other side, there are people who will cry, who will have burning, stinging, or contact dermatitis with chemical UV filter. That is known, right? So those are the issues with those. That's why people tend to not to like mineral, chemical UV filters, prefer mineral UV filters. But again, this white cast, you know, not every day is Halloween. Come on, nobody wants to look like a ghost. So that's where I feel for the cosmetic chemists or formulators in this country, because we don't have the perfect filters for them to work with. However, in the EU, they actually started to restrict some of the chemical filters as well. So they actually are start to kind of follow what US FDA is doing. So that is very interesting, given that they do have more choices. But, you know, sometimes more choices doesn't mean it's always better. It's interesting to see that the EU is actually following what US is doing in terms of regulating and restricting some of the uses of chemical UV filters. But back to my challenge is, we do have in our lab, you know, created new macro UV filters. So think about those very large chemical UV filters that actually, you know, because my specialty is transdermal drug delivery. I know what can make molecules get into the skin. And I also know what will make molecules not get into the skin, right? So you just reverse everything that's working for the being able to get in part. So we actually have those super large, but still you're not visible, it's not visible to the naked eye, large in like a microscopic point of view, that don't get absorbed into your skin at all. So that's chemical UV filter. So it's oil soluble or water soluble. So you can formulate very elegant sunscreen products and also can scientifically achieve SPF 1000 and can have really high UVA protection, have really high visible light protection. But again, those will be drugs, right? Those will be new drugs that we need to file with FDA. So we are working with people who have experience, you know, approving filters in this country, who worked with FDA and myself, you know, in the past, getting cancer drugs approved, you know, have done that. So I have some experiences, but, you know, to me, the challenge is time, resources, and money. Right. If you look at the stats, how many drugs are approved in this country by the FDA? 7.9%. 7.9% of drugs that are being presented to the US FDA is approved. And how much money it takes to bring a new drug to the market in the United States? Between $400 million to $2 billion. So that's why, you know, you don't really see a lot of the manufacturers wanting to go to that route, being like, I don't want to spend that much money to get this approved. I'm fine just selling in EU. I'm fine just selling in Asia. But I think another very controversial topic is on animal testing. For any drug to be approved in the United States, you need to provide animal data. But given the US consumer sentiment on animal testing, a lot of the manufacturers also don't want to do that. They'd rather not to sell in this country rather than, you know, show consumers it has been animal tested. But, you know, I think my point of view on this is there are animal testings that are necessary. There are animal testings that are excessive. I am against, or I think we should all against, excessive animal testing, unnecessary kind animal testing. But, you know, when you are truly treating as a drug in terms of safety, you do need some sort of model that are not humans to demonstrate safety. And you know, that is another layer why it has been very difficult for other filters outside of the US to get into this country.
Okay, I think that's a good point. And I was going to say too, I just want to reiterate that sunscreen is a drug in this country. That's why I believe that we touched on that, but I just wanted to make sure everyone was clear why Sophie is explaining. Like, this is all very important information.
That is my question, which I think I know what your answer is, but I just wanted to ask you directly, do you think that sunscreen should be classified as a drug? Do you agree with that?
So here is what's happening, right? So prevent cancer or prevent premature aging caused by the sun from FDA is a drug claim because you're preventing a disease. If you're preventing a disease, it is a drug. So that's why FDA is regulating it. But it's actually before, you know, there were two periods of time FDA regulated as a drug, then, okay, we don't want to regulate it, we want to become cosmetic. It's too much. Too many brands, become a cosmetic. What happened when FDA stopped regulating during that period of time is a lot of those sunscreen products tested have no sun protection at all. And that's where FDA was like, okay, we have to re-regulate it again, right? Because they don't want people to burn. So it really is about, are people doing what they're doing if it's not regulated? So that's why it's a very tricky situation in the United States. And, you know, like it is classified as both a drug and a cosmetic, which causes a lot of complexity for sure.
Can we talk about mineral sunscreens. And like you mentioned, like a lot of people, you know, like to use it for many reasons. It's usually not irritating to sensitive skin. Obviously, like when you're pregnant, they recommend you use mineral sunscreens. But the white cast, like you said, it's not Halloween every day. We don't want to look like we're wearing a mask. What can people do? What can brands do to make the mineral sunscreen have a minimal cast when they are using these mineral filters?
Yeah, so I think that's a
without giving away your secrets.
I think that's a billion-dollar question. You know, like I think everybody is trying to figure it out. I mean, it is. I think the whole chemical UV filter, mineral UV filter debate will stop if mineral UV filters do not have disadvantages like a white cast or a greasiness or how thick they are. You know, I think the current couple ways that people are doing, you know, number one is to make it tinted, right? So to really mask the white cast with pigment, right? Typically using iron oxide, sometimes using some other colorants as well, make it more like a foundation. But, you know, the downside of that is not universal, and you actually apply way less amount when it's a foundation. So you actually don't, you know, actually have good enough protection. And then the second way is actually, which in academia, we call it doping. So you actually put unapproved chemical UV filters in the inactive ingredient list and still call it a mineral sunscreen. So that is where, you know, you can have a fairly transparent, somewhat transparent mineral sunscreen. You see a low percentage of zinc and low percentage of titanium dioxide. And you're like, wow, this is so great. How is this SPF 30? How is this SPF 50? And you look into the inactive ingredient list. I guarantee your top five, you will find butyl-lactyl salicylate or triacyl salicylate or ethyl ferulate. So the first two, butyl-lactyl salicylate and triacyl salicylate, they are in the same salicylic chemical family compared to, or as, you know, homosalate and octisalate. Those are approved chemical UV filters. They're essentially sisters. And because that's where, you know, is it regulated as a drug or cosmetic comes in play? Because as a cosmetic, you don't have to go through FDA approval. So you can put that ingredient in and say it's a cosmetic ingredient. But it functions exactly like a chemical UV filter. It gives you very high SPF and it actually, you know, gets absorbed into your blood. So we have done study on those doping, we call it doping ingredients in academia and published in Journal of Investigative Dermatology and presented at AAD last year. Yeah, people don't know. Dermatologists don't know, right? Like it's like, oh, we thought we're recommending 100% mineral sunscreens, but we're not. Again, like back to my point on absorption risk to human, unknown, but for people who are allergic to chemical filters, it is a risk, right? It's like, oh, I thought I bought a mineral sunscreen. It's not. So that's where you can get it transparent. And a third ingredient that's commonly found in mineral sunscreens, ethyl ferulate. It is the chemical analog. Think about a cousin to octinoxate. And that is also very common in a lot of so-called 100% mineral sunscreens. But, you know, the purpose of them doing that really is to decrease the white cast. You know, like the white cast part is accomplished, but, you know, oftentimes I also don't blame brands for it because they probably don't know, right? Because imagine if I were a brand, I was like, okay, I want SPF 50, I want a mineral sunscreen, I don't want any white cast, and they will go out to labs, just create a sample for me, right? So oftentimes they don't know that those doping ingredients were added.
Okay, this is where I am like, is this a clusterfuck of epic proportions? Like, what are we doing here? And to your point, if you have irritation to chemical sunscreens, that is a problem.
My biggest problem is actually with ethyl ferulate. So why? Because, you know, me as a scientist in the lab, yes, you know, I do read the safety data sheet. Ethyl ferulate, you know, the safety data sheet, the first thing it says is strong irritant to skin and eye. Wash if in contact. So what is the purpose of putting it into a topical skincare product? You know, if it is classified as a strong skin and eye irritant.
Is having those ingredients that are like the sisters or cousins of these chemical filters, is this kind of like when you mentioned Latisse? Latisse is a drug and is regulated as a drug. And it includes an ingredient called, the prostaglandin analogs. Then you have these lash serums that they can't literally say they'll grow your lashes, but they'll say they quote unquote enhance your lashes. They're considered cosmetics, but they literally have like, if not the exact, like a sister of a prostaglandin analog in there that has the exact same problems as the prostaglandin analog. Is that kind of what you're saying when it comes to these sunscreens that are utilizing these sister and cousin sunscreens?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very great analogy. But I would say, though, so for sunscreen, I think the regulation here in the United States is that you can't add a single ingredient that is not on the US FDA monograph, right? Those UV filters in your product that standalone creates more than SPF 2. So if you do add ingredients that are not approved on the monograph, and that actually contributes to higher than SPF 2 for the product, you are selling an unapproved drug.
If it's under 2%, though, does that even benefit the use of it as a sunscreen in terms of protection?
So here's the thing, right? So like, we don't know the percentage of what people are adding those ingredients, but we actually know, right? Like they're not disclosed because they're in the inactive ingredient, but it's typically at a percentage of, you know, 5% or up to 10% of butyl lactyl salicylate or triacyl salicylate. It's very, very high. And I don't want to name names, but there's a supplier that supplies ethyl frulate saying adding very little, it's less than 1%. Adding this little of ethyl frulate can contribute to SPF 27. They blatantly say it.
I'm just but like,
how is that even possible?
I need you to ask your question.
Okay, okay.
Kirby.
So, okay. I visited the lab, the Pavis lab in 2023. It was really fun, especially for a little science nerd like me, okay? And I was there with several other editors. We learned about the dynamic age defense. We learned about the specific zinc oxide that Sophie utilizes within her formulation versus other people's. And we had the opportunity to see several sunscreens that are popular and on the market. We were not privy to what these brands were. If we were, I feel like I would have a moral obligation to do something about this. But there were three, and then there was Pavis, I believe. And the three that made these claims of being SPF 30 or SPF whatever were not only not the SPF that they had claimed, but like egregiously lower than what they had claimed. And so, Sophie, for me and Sarah, we want to know, like,
how is that legal?
How is that even possible? Like, what needs to be done to ensure that sunscreens are actually living up to their claims? Because it seems like there's a variety of ways and a variety of labs to test these things, and there's no uniformity. So, like, what, in your opinion, needs to be done to ensure that if we're going to be buying these sometimes rather expensive in sunscreens that we think are necessary to wear, we're actually getting the protection that are being claimed?
Yeah, I mean, before launching Pavis, you know, I never intended to launch a brand. I'm not a celebrity. I'm not an influencer. I don't do marketing. I never intended wanting to launch a brand. We tested a lot of the sunscreens on the market, and a lot of them fall short on claims. And that's disheartening, right? But I also think it's also because of, number one, sunscreen testing is very messy. Why do I say that? So in the United States, SPF is tested in vivo. So you have a panel of 10 volunteers or more, and you look at erythema, right? So you look like how long does your back turn red under the artificial UV lamps. And then you compare to the part that is covered by your sunscreen product, and how long that turns red, and you divide. And then that number is your SPF number, right? So it's basically, let's say, Kirby, it takes you 1 minute to burn, okay? So unprotected skin, it takes you 1 minute to burn. And on the protected side, it takes you 20 minutes to burn. So this SPF value for this product is SPF 20. It's 20 minutes divided by 1 minute. is how it's calculated. But that's where the problem is. The problem is it's different for different people, how long it takes to burn. So your denominator can vary by so much, because I don't know about you, Sarah, but it may take me an hour to burn, right? But will an SPF 20 on Kirby provide 20 hours of protection on me? I highly doubt it. You know, it is why there's huge discrepancy that oftentimes the in vivo SPF results are not able to be replicated, right? So to what extent in vitro is more uniform because you take out the human part, right? You take out, because there are other tricks for, you know, if people really want to cheat the system, you know, like there are other parts to identify volunteers that will burn really quickly on unprotected, so we can artificially have a really high SPF number, right? Those indication could be, has this person have a sunburn in recent months? Has this person been out of the sun? Has this, like, you know, there are a lot of things, or season when it's tested. There are a lot of things that people can manipulate to get the desired result. And that leads to oftentimes claims fell short. I don't know if you guys know this AMA lab scandal. AMA was a testing lab that was producing fake SPF results for US sunscreens that eventually was reported to the US FDA. They had to pay, I think, $40 million, and the founder went to jail. The founder was convicted to jail. I think it was sentenced to 5 years for faking.
Oh, this is ringing a bell. Yeah, I remember this. Yeah. Okay. But this was, what, like 5 years ago? When was this?
It was recent, because the conviction was 2021. So it was not that
long. Okay, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you argue that these brands that are making these sunscreens that either claiming that it's mineral and actually contain chemical ingredients, or claiming it's an SPF 50, but actually it's an SPF 2. Like, wouldn't you say that that's also like grounds for being sued? Like, because you're claiming that it is a sunscreen to prevent skin cancer. So it's a disease, it's a drug, but it's not, right?
Yeah. Like, so I think one part, you know, is we know the consumer demand, and also this is a very competitive industry, right? Everybody wants a very high SPF number, right? But also want the cosmetic elegance, and also want it to be cheap. And there are so many things going on to make it happen. You know, it's like, okay, from a testing lab perspective, if I don't produce this result for you, I'm losing the business, right? Others who are less ethical will get your business. So it's kind of like a vicious cycle in a way that is not great for consumers. But at the same time, SPF is just one part of the story. You know, the broad spectrum claim is I'm even more disappointed in, because broad spectrum in this country, right? So it was supposed to mean for UVA protection. But I remember actually reading the document back then when broad spectrum was proposed to the US FDA. The rationale was that, oh, we propose this method because it's easy to pass. I'm like, what? It's easy for existing sunscreens to pass. That's why you recommend it, how you test broad spectrum. So for people who don't know, broad spectrum in the US, as of right now, is tested for a critical wavelength method. That is basically to have a critical wavelength longer than 370 nanometer. But this method is very flawed. Why? Number one, it's UVB dependent. This has nothing to do with UVB, right? When you're doing a UVA testing, why do you have to, you know, put UVB into the calculation? And number two is this method does not show you the level of UVA protection at all. It only shows you there's some UVA protection. But how much? We don't know. That's why, you know, like when we worked with Massachusetts General Hospital of, you know, Department of Dermatology, they tested, you know, 20 plus sunscreens, and the broad spectrum, right? They are all broad spectrum because it's a requirement in this country, all over the place, right? So it's like there are some sunscreens that have really high UV protection, but there are some just almost none, but still passed this method of testing broad spectrum. But FDA realized that problem, so they actually, in their new proposed rule I mentioned about, they proposed a new way of measuring broad spectrum. Like, you have to do additional test, which is much more stringent, which is a much better metric. However, you know, from government saying, okay, we propose this to its in effect, it's going to take at least a couple more years. So, you know, it's a long way to go, but at least FDA has recognized the problem of broad spectrum does not tell you the truth about UVA protection.
Yeah, I think this kind of dives nicely into our next question, because UVA, aging rays, I know this because I worked in a tanning salon as a teenager. Live and learn. I grew up in Texas, so Sophie, don't shame me. But UVA, aging rays, UVB, burn rays. So Sophie's hero product is this Pavise Dynamic Age Defense SPF 30. And I personally love it. Sarah just received it. She's going to be giving it a go, but she is wearing the Pavise lip right now. It's proven to reverse and delay skin aging, which is obviously something you're super passionate about and know a lot about. Some would say it's one expensive sunscreen at $148, but it's also a treatment and a moisturizer. So
yeah,
can you explain a little bit about how you measured the effectiveness of this product and why was it important just to make more than just a sunscreen?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, like, I want to answer your question on price first. If I were to make it cheap, $20, $10, I would. Because, you know, it's a very hard battle to fight when your price point is so high. But, you know, like, as a cancer drug developer before, you know, for us, when we think about designing or inventing, creating something effective, cost was never in the question, right? So it's like, do whatever it takes to make it work. And that has been our philosophy for the longest time. And we create our own UV filter. We create a diamond core UV filter ourselves. And no brands does that. No brands create UV filters. And to the pharmaceutical level of testing, you know, Kirby has seen that we do so much clinical testing in vivo, in vitro. We work with hospitals. We do a lot of trials. That's very expensive. And also from an ingredient point of view, you know, so there are so many suppliers supply the same commodity ingredient, right? For example, niacinamide, there are like a ton of suppliers do that. Or, you know, ceramides, a ton of suppliers do that. One accident may realize quality is different. So I actually was using one organic solvent for my chemical synthesis work for my eczema drugs. It was, you know, have nothing to do with Pavise. Back in the days, 2020, and, you know, I ran out of that solvent from that manufacturer, so I had to find an alternative. Okay, I just purchased an alternative. But given those are for pharmaceutical use, right, those, you know, like, should it be higher quality or higher purity, per se, higher safety? When I was doing the experiment, so, you know, chemical synthesis, a lot of things happens, right, like, temperature change, pressure, and reagents, all of those, you know, stuff happening. I start to notice this very strong, very unpleasant smell. And that was never happened before when I was using the other branded solvent. And that's when I said, what is this? Right? So like my alarm as a, you know, chemical engineer just all of a sudden be like, what is this? So we actually sent this product to the chemical analytical lab at Harvard with my colleagues to tell me what's in it. Guess what's in it? Formaldehyde. So that was the moment being like, okay, so, you know, they may say the same chemical name, but who supplies it matters. And that's, you know, when we made sure, yes, our own diamond core needs to be the highest standard, you know, has to be the best of the best, but also we want to make sure other ingredients we use are living up to that standard, and that also increased our cost as well. You know, our COGS is not a typical cosmetic COGS, and that's where we are. But, you know, what I can tell you is that because the Diamond Core was able to scavenge reactive oxygen species, so think of those harmful particles are generated by UV rays or by environmental damages, that is the single most important thing in terms of triggering all the other different aging processes. So who is able to solve the ROS issue? Who can stop premature skin aging? So that's what Diamond Core was invented at the time. So, you know, like think about accidental scientific discovery. I wasn't set out to create a transparent mineral filter. I was set out to scavenge ROS. And then it was after, okay, this ROS scavenging or eradicating mechanism is proven to work. Then we realized, oh, I mean, Kirby has seen this in the lab. It's so much more transparent than other zinc. So the transparency part is an accidental discovery that wasn't intended when we set out to create this molecule.
Also, can I just say that measuring zinc is extremely hard, by the way. Like, if you guys have ever had to measure a powder, like get a food scale, and then try to perfectly put on powdered sugar onto the scale to like reach your design. It is so hard. All of us were like, who can get it the closest? Like we're trying so hard. So that alone makes me not eligible to be in the lab because I can't properly. I can't properly measure powder, but okay, keep going, Sophie.
But you created a molecule.
I did create a molecule. You know? Can you explain, obviously, like clinicals to back this up, right? Like there's data that actually back this up too.
Yeah, I mean, we've done extensive clinical trials, and because, because of the ROS scavenging, you know, so we actually utilized a mechanism of action called high efficiency electron shuttling. So we're able to shuttle electrons to the way we wanted. I know it sounds very complex. It is complex, so it's fine. But, you know, because we're able to do that, we can promote wound healing and skin regeneration. And that has been proven in our new set of clinical studies to show the wound healing benefit. And that's why for us, you know, physicians love us because they see tremendous result with post-laser, post-surgery to see, you know, the accelerated recovery. But, you know, another thing I mentioned about is our Diamond Core surface property actually helps to deliver other topical skincare ingredients, typically harder to deliver. And we have conducted study to show it helps niacinamide to penetrate deeper into the skin to work better, right? So those are so many benefit or I guess functions of this molecule that is not just a sunscreen. And going back to, you know, people are like, oh my gosh, $140 sunscreen, you're crazy. Yes, I'm crazy. If I want to create a sunscreen, just a sunscreen for $148. Yeah, of course, but it is not. When we look at this problem, we don't want to be confined in traditional category norms. We're not thinking, okay, let's create a sunscreen, let's create a moisturizer, let's create a night cream, let's create a serum. We're not thinking any of that. We're thinking, what is the problem? Problem is skin aging, which includes skin cancer. And what is the cause of it? It's UV exposure, especially the UVA range, which we talked about broad spectrum doesn't tell you much. And second is ROS, and nobody is talking about ROS. So we're able to solve those two problems by Diamond Core and by some of our, you know, like a cocktail ingredients. That's why you see results you don't typically see from a sunscreen product. So it's very difficult for me to why does your sunscreen do this? Other sunscreen don't do that? Because, you know, it wasn't created as a sunscreen to start. But I do want to use an analogy of nobody thought iPhone would be iPhone without it launched, right? So phone was a phone, but nobody thought phone can be a camera. Nobody thought phone can be a GPS, right? Nobody thought a phone can allow us to do this podcast right now until Apple did it, right? So that's where, you know, I think we still continue just trying to solve problems people are facing to forget about what category we're in.
And with that, Pavis is the Apple of sun care. Here we go. Or skincare, however you want to put it. I would say skincare. We could talk to you for literally 3 more hours.
But I do want to say one little thing though, because I know my friend's point is not for everybody. For people who are looking for reliable SPF truthful products, I do recommend La Roche-Posay. From the tested brands, I have tested and found their products to be living up to their claims.
Wow, what an endorsement. What an endorsement.
Thank you for that. I tip my hat to you because truly I love this product. I really do use it regularly. And I have even noticed with my own hyperpigmentation on my face, it being subsided. And I do feel that Pavise has contributed to that.
You are brilliant. We're so, so lucky to have had you on the podcast. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
I have a feeling people will have to listen to this episode twice to fully comprehend the amount of knowledge that was dropped here. Sophie, where can everybody find Pavise?
So you can learn more about Pavise on pavise.com. And you can also go to our physician partners. You know, we are in more than 300 dermatologist offices in this country. So that, you know, you can find them. But again, I do think no skincare is as magic as you being healthy, stress-free, and eat well, sleep well. So you don't have to, you know, break a leg just to buy our product. And that is against our ethos, is to make efficacious product, to use true scientific innovation to make you not just feel better, but, you know, overall live better.
All right, that's it. Thank you everyone for listening. We will be back on Tuesday with the week's most buzzy beauty news.
Make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Spotify so you don't miss any breaking beauty news or product reviews. And if you want to support us, be sure to follow us at Gloss Angeles Pod on all platforms and join our Facebook group.
Plus, find every product we recommend on our website, glossangelespod.com, as well as links to the stories and news we report each week. You can follow us, your hosts. I'm Sarah Tan, that's S-A-R-A-T-A-N, on all social platforms.
And I'm Kirby Johnson, K-I-R-B-I-E, on all social platforms.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.